This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Global climate change is a reality. Predicting the future is an inexact science, to say the least, but it's safe to say that economists, military leaders, heads of state, and certainly scientists are all trying to figure out how best to deal with the likely scenarios. Our guest today says business leaders and entrepreneurs should be trying not only to mitigate the damage caused by climate change, but to see the opportunities. We do live in a capitalist society, after all, and there are ways to be green in both the eco sense and the financial sense. Jigar Shah is president and co-founder of Generate Capital, a company that funds small-scale clean tech businesses. He's the keynote speaker at a summit today at Vermont Technical College in Randolph, being put on by the Vermont Council on Rural Development. The summit's focus is on creating prosperity and opportunity while confronting climate change. Jigar Shah, welcome to Vermont Edition. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Climate change is sometimes, maybe often, portrayed as just an unmitigated threat to our way of life in any number of ways. But I gather that's not how you see it, or at least not the only way you see it. How do you see
as an entrepreneur, you know, when you see problems, you actually are always seeking solutions. And from those solutions, you create wealth, not only for yourself, but for all the employees that you hire and all the people that you serve.
So do you look at climate change as something bad that we need to fix, or something that's a reality that we need to figure out how to live with? I mean, how do you sort of situate it?
Well, I think that when you think about the way that our world works today, it is so complex that no one person can actually even fathom how that works, whether it's a coal plant that basically derives its coal from the middle of Wyoming, trains it all the way to the East Coast, then burns it in the plant, and then creates all these pollutants, which then we put a scrubber technology on top of it, which creates ash, which then you have to store. And the list goes on and on and on. And you can imagine that when you think about one of the pollutants that come off of that, it's climate change. But the whole system is so complex that it's easier just to make solar panels off your own roof.
We got a note from Stephen before the show who says, climate change is just one of a whole host of environmental and social problems we face, most of them the product of an economic system based on profit and growth. It seems to me that the real solutions to our problems will require a scaling down of economic activity. But Mr. Shah and others like him see climate change as just another opportunity to continue business as usual, this time painted green. Is that true?
Well, look, I certainly believe that this is the largest wealth creation opportunity of our time. And I think when you think about where I was born in India, there's still 300 million people that don't have access to electricity and 500 million people that don't have access to regular sanitation and clean water. And the solutions that we've invented since the 1970s are ready to go. In fact, we're providing electricity now to 1 million people a month in these countries using solar home systems where coal and other, you know, solutions weren't able to reach them in the past. And so, look, I think that getting people essential services so they can live their lives the way that they want to live them is something that we should all aspire to.
We're talking about economic opportunity in the face of climate change. And listeners, if this is something that you think about or you have a question for our guest, Jigar Shah, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You know, you're mentioning solutions that are being found to problems in the developing world, in India. That's one thing that you think that the U.S. should perhaps take a look at, ways to solve problems and maybe look at models in the developing world rather than think that we have it all solved, something like how to get electricity to rural villages. And certainly here in Vermont, we struggle with how to get internet connectivity and cell phone connectivity to other parts of the state that are isolated geographically. So do you see opportunities already out there in the world to solve some of these problems that we see in terms of getting to renewable energy resources?
Yeah, I think when you think about the 20th century, the 20th century was really all about bigger is better, right? So if you were building a 1,000-megawatt coal plant, a 2,000-megawatt coal plant would be better. Today, because of the technology breakthroughs that we've had in mobile phone service or in the internet and other things, you can really pursue small as beautiful. When you think about solar systems, for instance, in the United States, you know, we did about $20 billion worth of solar last year in the United States, but we did them $150,000 at a time. These were thousands of very small systems that we aggregated up to making a $20 billion business. And so I think whether you're talking about Vermont Gas's desire to connect communities to natural gas or whether you're talking about electricity, there are distributed solutions now. So in Vermont Gas's case, you can use wood pellet stoves, you can use air source heat pumps, you can use lots of different technologies on a distributed basis that prevents you from having to spend the money to tear up perfectly good roads to build in natural gas pipelines.
So you mean instead of going the way Vermont Gas Systems wanted to go in building out that pipeline all the way to International Paper, which they've now canceled that part of it, but still planning, they say, to try to build a pipeline down to Middlebury, you say maybe we don't even need that.
Well, not just that I say, I think the data shows that it's a lot cheaper to be able to do this on a distributed basis because you're taking perfectly good infrastructure, perfectly good roads and sidewalks and other infrastructure and tearing it up to be able to build that pipeline, which costs a lot of money today.
So when you see those distributed sources, do you see big companies building small-scale projects, or do you see lots of small companies, maybe even community resources, doing things on these small scale?
Well, I think that the marketplace is a diverse area, and so everyone's got a shot. But if the solar industry is any guide, the vast majority of the solar industry today is made up of companies like the one I started, SunEdison, which is less than 15 years old. And so these are community-based organizations where people saw a problem locally, like there's a company in Vermont, I think, called SunCommon, and others, which are, you know, local community-based organizations that have decided to meet the needs of their local community and then happen to be really good at business and got to become big companies.
And is that going to be enough? So you do see them growing into big companies. I mean, if we want to sort of solve the energy problems of the world, are small companies going to be able to do it, or are we going to need these monolithic big companies in the end?
Well, I think you need both. I mean, SunEdison, you know, now does over $3 billion of solar a year. And because of that, it has access to Wall Street and low cost of capital and all the things that you would want to see in a mature business. But we have 7,000 solar installers in the United States. Each one of them is very, very important because they're attending the church groups and the local community center meetings and all the things that you need to do to educate the local population. And they get services from folks like SunEdison and other, you know, distributors and finance providers. And so you're going to see an entire ecosystem that evolves, but I don't think the solar industry or any of the other industries in the resource revolution are going to be dominated by any one company.
We got a note from Tom in Burlington who says, I'm a young professional with no real solar experience looking to get into the industry. What's the best way for me to get my foot in the door? Is it through education, hands-on experience, both, or something else? And are there any online resources that you recommend?
Well, the answer is always both in these cases. You know, the easiest way to get into the solar industry right now is in sales. You know, we've got a lot of engineers and others that are have joined our movement, but we're missing salespeople. And so that's the easiest way to get a job next week if you want one. But there's a lot of resources online from the Florida Solar Energy Center to the Solar Center in Colorado, all of which has online courses, YouTube videos, et cetera, that allow you to you know, beef up on your solar knowledge.
So there are starting to be educational opportunities and training opportunities even in emerging businesses like this.
Well, I mean, in solar's case, solar curriculum is actually taught at 50 community colleges across the country. That curriculum was, you know, created back in 2008, 2009. There have been thousands of people that have gone through the curriculum. And so in solar's case, as well as energy efficiency, home audits, I mean, some of those areas are quite mature.
You've been using solar as an example, partly because I assume it, partly because it's an industry you know so well as one of the founders of SunEdison. But the solar sector has also seen some pretty massive failures, very high profile disappointments. Thinking just off the top of my head of Solyndra, which went bankrupt after getting a lot of money from the federal government. Did Solyndra's bankruptcy set back the green tech industry's progression or its reputation in any way?
Well, luckily, not at all. I think that when you look at these types of industries, we once had over 200 automakers, and now we've got 3. And so that means a lot of them were either consolidated or went out of business. The same thing's true for electric companies. We had an electric company in every single town in Vermont and other places until they were consolidated into GMP or monopolies. And so I think that, you know, there will always be failures in a capitalist society. The good thing about the solar industry is we kept our head down and actually just kept performing while we were out of political favor. And the last two State of the Unions, the president was no longer embarrassed to talk about us and mentioned solar in both of the last two State of the Unions.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Cornwall. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. This is John Isham from Cornwall.
Hi, John.
And I have two motives for calling. One is that I'm going to have this wonderful episode played to my introductory microeconomics students at Middlebury College. So I'm trying to get on your tape so they'll hear this. So I hope you indulge me on that.
Well, you're already on.
Thank you. This is a great show you have, and it's just so exciting to hear this perspective, what it's doing for Vermont and elsewhere. A challenge is this: we need a carbon tax, because a carbon tax will accelerate getting towards the clean energy solutions that await, led by folks like your guest. So I'd like to ask him the role that he and his industry colleagues are playing in getting us to a carbon tax, or its equivalent, a kind of cap on carbon emissions.
John, thanks for the call. John Isham is the faculty director at the Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Middlebury College. Jiggershaw, what do you think?
So I'm not a huge fan of cap and trade. I think cap and trade needs a monolithic industry like the electric utility sector, where we have cap and trade for sulfur dioxides and nitrogen dioxides. But I think for carbon, I'm more in favor of a carbon tax, because I think it's just a lot easier to administer than the economy-wide cap and trade system. But I think where I may differ from John is that I think that the carbon tax can be remarkably small. Today, when you look at McKinsey's Resource Revolution report, it shows that there's over 300 technologies that can largely, you know, get rid of 50% of the carbon emissions in Vermont, without any price on carbon. So in fact, they're already cost effective without subsidies. The reason we don't do them is because of inertia. So I think if you put in a carbon tax of just, let's call it $3, to use a random number, it would have almost no perceptible impact on the costs of goods and services in Vermont, but it would force every CFO in the state of Vermont to add a line in their spreadsheet for carbon, which means that they're actually going to start regulating it and start doing things that already make financial sense that they just haven't gotten around to.
So for you, this idea of inertia, I mean, you've said that you think we have the technology already, for example, to get away from our dependence on fossil fuels. The technology is out there. It's just that we need the willpower to do it. And that, the carbon tax, you think would help push movement?
Yeah, and it's not willpower per se, right? It's just prioritization. You know, I think there's a lot of folks who want to put solar, let's say, on their house. But when they come down to writing the check for it, one of the members of the household says, well, I'd rather get a new kitchen, or I'd rather replace my car this year, or I'd rather send my kid to summer camp. And so the solar system purchase just goes down the priority list, which is why we introduced no money down financing for solar. So it's not competing with other priorities of your household. Businesses are exactly the same. They want to add a new division. They want to buy an improved piece of equipment. But the rate of return on that piece of equipment may only be 12%, where the rate of return on energy efficiency might be 20%. But they would still rather do something that they believe to be core to their business instead of doing energy efficiency, which is why this carbon tax and all this other stuff needs to be in place, even if it's not a high number, just to get people to just refocus another 5 minutes of their attention onto these micro decisions that they're constantly making every day, which is actually not in their financial best interest, but they do them because it's easy to just keep things exactly the same as they are.
You also just a moment ago mentioned subsidies, and as I understand it, you think that basically all government subsidies in the energy sector should be eliminated. Is that true?
Yeah, I've certainly taken a lot of arrows to the back on that, but I do think that that if we actually eliminated subsidies and made it a level playing field, it'd be better. That being said, we don't have a level playing field, which is why we have these subsidies in place in the first place. And I do think that whether it's the reset legislation that the governor is pushing through or other things, there's a lot of folks who are really uneducated about these topics who are saying, well, we don't want subsidies for wind and solar or whatnot. But when you actually add, let's say, pollution control equipment to a coal plant in New Hampshire, as they did, and they raised rates by over 10% to do that, that's a subsidy. It's just called something different. It's just called, you know, raising electricity rates to pay for this thing. When you look at renewable portfolio standards across the United States, they have raised rates less than 1% total, not 1% a year, 1% total to pay for their implementation. That's far less than pollution control equipment on coal or on, you know, upgrading distribution substations.
But so to clarify then, I mean, you said it's not a level playing field, but eliminating all the subsidies, the idea there is so that it is a level playing field. So everybody's coming to the table with the same, you know, having to pay the same thing and having to get the same part of the market share. You know, a lot of people say new technologies need subsidies to get off the ground and that would be more fair because the old technologies also had subsidies to help them get off the ground. Do you think something like solar or wind or other renewable energy pieces can do it without subsidies?
Well, in 2017, yes. I mean, I think that the Bush administration left us with a parting gift of an 8-year extension of the solar tax credit in the fall of 2008. Once that 8-year tax credit expires at the end of 2016, solar will be cost effective to live without that subsidy. And we're already showing that we can do that throughout a lot of the projects that we've announced over the last couple of years. And so I think solar is one of those technologies that was nowhere in 2008 and today is, you know, now adding more megawatts than wind or any other power generation technology in the United States. I mean, you know, this year, over 60% of all new power additions are going to be renewable in the United States.
We're talking about economic opportunity in the face of climate change. A conference in Vermont today is exploring how Vermont businesses can be out in front in the energy sector and elsewhere to position themselves in the global economy. If you're thinking about this, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Wayne Michaud, the director of Idle Free Vermont, who says prosperity in mitigating climate change can extend to the transportation sector. Business fleets can realize many thousands of dollars in savings annually by training their drivers to simply avoid unnecessary idling, adopt no idling policies, and can also equip their fleets with idle reduction technologies that have a great return on investment. You can share your thoughts. Again, 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're getting the perspective of Jigar Shah. He has started up several businesses that aim to maneuver in a world where climate change is a reality and to make money on renewable energy innovations. Shah is the keynote speaker at a summit today at Vermont Technical College in Randolph. The summit's focus is on creating prosperity and opportunity confronting climate change. And we're hearing from some of you as well who are thinking about this or have questions for our guest. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can continue the conversation on Vermont Edition's Facebook page. And let's go to Susanna, who's calling in from Walden. Hi, Susanna. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say that when I hear phrases like opportunities for prosperity and things like...
Oh, Susanna, I think we lost you. We'll see if we can get you back on the line there. Let's go to Isaac, who's with us from Fairfax. Hi, Isaac.
Yes, hi. I'm just curious, on your guest's thoughts on the cross-subsidization with residential solar, the subsidy that the non-residential solar owner pays to the utility, basically, for those who do have solar on their rooftops. So I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Isaac, thanks for the call. Jigar Shah, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a really complex question, and it's one that I am, you know, sort of forced to hear about a lot. I think when you think about the cross-subsidization of different pieces of the electricity puzzle, that that happens all the time. So for instance, the residential customer pays more than their fair share of fixed costs to the grid, and industrial customers are able to get away scot-free and not pay their fair share. So as long as a residential solar customer doesn't drop their price to zero, but actually gets their bill down, let's say 90% or 80%, they're still paying their fair share for the fixed costs. It gets really esoteric and very complicated. But I think that the better way of thinking about this is that the reason why electricity rates are going up so fast right now is all of our stuff is old. All of it's 50 years old, and we have to replace it, and labor rates are higher, and steel costs are higher, and concrete's higher. And so the question is, do we really have to replace all those old distribution substations, or can we use solar, targeted energy efficiency, targeted combined heat and power, targeted anaerobic digesters to extend the life of that infrastructure for 10 or more years? And the answer is we can. And that's a much more productive conversation to have than this sort of trumped up conversation around cross-subsidization of solar.
Let's go to Mark in Fletcher. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you. As an investor in small domestic alternative energy, I'm seeing two cultures emerge here, the corporate culture, which is subsidized or whatever you want to call that, at a much higher rate than the individual infrastructure. And my interest is, as a renegade who's doing it myself, I don't get any of those benefits, and I can't get on the grid unless I go through that other structure that is geared to make you go into debt to invest in it. That's unnecessary on a smaller scale, and they're just inflating the price of it. And my other interest is I live in view of Georgia... windmill project there, and the conversation in the town surrounding it is like a lot of people have been stirred up against it by outside interests, but the reality is most people would accept it if they had first dibs on the power generated before it went out of state or wherever to the highest bidder. They would be much more amenable to all these projects if the local communities through microgrids got the first benefit and the lasting benefit of it, and they're more resilient that way instead of relying on a large structure that's rigged. That's my statement and question.
Yeah, Mark, thanks for the call. Let's take that question about local communities getting the benefit out of projects that are in their backyard first. Jigar Shah, what about what Mark's talking about?
Yeah, I think that is a brilliant idea, and it's something that, you know, a lot of us refer to as community solar or community wind, and you know, I think what it speaks to is what's happening here today at Vermont Technical College, which is there's 450 people here who are all working together to figure out how to make those solutions work. And what that really means is that when you have a cash flow stream coming out of this wind turbine, so let's say it costs $100 million to build and there's $12 million a year of cash flow coming off of that, where does that cash go? Some of it goes to pay rent to the folks who own the land who are putting solar or wind farms on their land. Some of that could go to folks who want to lock in their electricity prices at today's prices and avoid the 3-4% rate increases per year that they're getting from the utility company. And others can go to local workforce development that helps people get the training that they need to create a career in this solution. And so I do think that there's a community approach here. And frankly, going forward, that's the way it has to go. I mean, I think having random solar farms and wind farms dotting the landscape without any real planning and community involvement doesn't make any sense for business or for the community.
We got a note from Annette Smith who says, would Mr. Shah please speak to the social and ethical responsibility that comes with solar and wind development, in particular what his company plans to do to address the harm being done to neighbors of his company's Sheffield Wind project, which is polluting the area with noise. So Sun Edison purchased First Wind, which had developed the Sheffield Wind project. Jigar Shah, you were a founder and a CEO of Sun Edison, though you're not CEO anymore. But to Annette Smith's point, the social and ethical responsibilities that come with this kind of building in communities.
Yeah, look, I mean, if we want to build $3 billion of solar a year, which is what SunEdison's doing now, and then now they're adding another billion or so a year in wind, you are going to create an enormous number of side effects that have to be dealt with. I mean, when we were doing a project in San Diego, it happened to be that one guy's house was literally at the exact point so that once a day we were reflecting so much sunlight into his front window that it was making it unlivable in his front window for that 10-minute period. These are things you have to deal with. I mean, we have to coexist with industrial building. Otherwise, we have to decide to give up on a lot of the amenities that we want, whether it's electricity or clean drinking water or natural gas for heat or whatever it is that we want. And so, look, I think that there will always be these things. I don't know the facts of this particular case, but there will always be these things. And that's why, frankly, I think litigation works. I mean, that's why folks have to sue for their rights and make sure that they're protected properly against these side effects. But my sense is that, you know, knowing SunEdison as I do, I'm sure that they're in active communication with those two homeowners, and they're just in an impasse.
Let's go back to Susanna in Walden, who got cut off earlier. Susanna, hi. I think you're back. You're here.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I just want to say to what you just said. Actually, I have a letter here in front of me that SunEdison wrote to the Therians. It says, "To be absolutely clear, we declined to pay the amount you request, leaving no further issues to be discussed." And they were only asking that SunEdison buy their whole property, not just the house. They have 50 acres that they've had to abandon. And
you know, Susanna, I'm
going to
stop you on this because you're right. This is an important issue. But, you know, Jigarshaw said he's not familiar with this particular case. But I know you can also probably speak to some wider questions you have about this kind of development. So do you have a question for him?
I'm just wondering why. What I'm hearing is all business talk, and business has created the problems with the environment and the biosphere. And as long as we are asking the question, how can we continue this economic system and live in our luxuries and comforts while maybe addressing some of these issues, that we're never going to get anywhere on climate change if that's the way we're framing things.
Hmm.
We need to be asking, how can we live in healthy reciprocity with the land base and the biosphere, and not that will not include these businesses. Like earlier when you introduced the show, you talked about capitalism, that we live in a capitalist society. I think it's time for us to ask bigger questions about why we do,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that we shouldn't.
Yeah, Susanna, I take your point, and thank you for that. Jigarshaw, you know, this is not the first time I'm sure you've heard these kinds of questions before, but also not the first time in the show, people pushing back on this idea of, you know, looking at it as a way, you know, profit-driving the ability to have these technologies. So what do you think?
Well, look, I think when you think about, first of all, let me just say that I completely agree. You know, I was the first person after the financial crisis of 2008 to stand up and say, you know, this system that we're living in needs improvement. I mean, whether it's another form of capitalism or whether it's an entirely new form altogether, we certainly need to talk about that. That being said, climate change is on our doorstep. And the only way to solve these problems is $1 trillion at a time. I mean, just to be clear, right? If we deploy $1 trillion of solar power, we still haven't replaced the entire electricity generation system with solar. And if we replace $1 trillion of gasoline-powered vehicles with electric vehicles, we still haven't solved the gasoline and oil problem, right? So these are $1 trillion solutions. Right now, the way that I know how to deploy $1 trillion worth of infrastructure, which solar is now on track to do over the next 3 to 4 years, is through capitalism. Now, if you want to read Naomi Klein's new book and talk to, you know, how we change capitalism, we should absolutely get those ideas on the table. But until we move to a new form of capitalism, to suggest that we should all sit there and just, you know, take in the coal power and all the health impacts that come from it is ridiculous.
You mentioned the transportation sector, and let's drill down on Vermont and the transportation sector. You know, that is by far the biggest problem with fossil fuels that Vermont has. It's in our transportation sector. People drive. People have cars that are not particularly fuel efficient. There are not a lot of Vermonters who can afford the uber fuel efficient cars, let alone any new car. So what's the, you know, how do you get us to the point where we are cutting our carbon emissions in the transportation sector in Vermont, where, you know, individuals are able to do that?
I think you have to start from the perspective of where we are, which is, so if you look at the American Automobile Association, AAA, they do a survey every year that says, here's how much it costs to own a car on average in the United States. This is people who are buying used cars, people who are buying new cars. It includes maintenance and fuel and insurance and all those things. We pay roughly 60.6 cents per mile in this country to own our cars. That's roughly $800 a month. You know, when I used to live in Norwich, Vermont in 1996, 97, my rent wasn't $800 a month. And so there are people all the time that are paying more for their cars and all the things that go along with it than they're paying for rent and for housing. And so I think first we have to start from the premise that just because money's dribbling out of your pocket, $20 a week, doesn't mean you're not paying a lot for transportation. You are. And even the poor are paying a lot for transportation. And when you look at Vermont, you know, they're doing a lot of fantastic things, whether it's walkable cities or whatnot, but, you know, they're not solving the fundamental problem, which is that about one fourth of the entire land area of Burlington or Montpelier or Rutland or Brattleboro is non-taxable land. It's free land that we've given to the auto industry for roads, for parking lots, for all these things that we're not actually getting compensated for at all. And so when you think about what it costs to be a Vermonter and to get transportation services, it's over $1 billion a year that we pay for gasoline and we pay for all these things. So now once we look at it from that context, the question is how much money is going to change and how much money is going to the status quo? My guess is that 95% of all the money being spent in Vermont is going to fixing existing roads, fixing existing infrastructure so people can live on the existing system. And 5% is being spent on electric vehicles and car sharing, van pools, and all the things that we know could dramatically decrease the cost of people's monthly mobility bills. And so I think this is absolutely ripe for enormous wealth creation, you know, folks actually coming together and figuring out, hey, you know, I'm underemployed. Why don't I actually drive folks using my car to places and get paid for that in a much cheaper way than they can do it on their own?
So is there a role for government in making that push as well?
The government starts all of this. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I've been accused many times of being a libertarian and all sorts of things, but when you talk about infrastructure, which is what we're really talking about, the government has a role, whether it's money that they're providing or whether it's just planning, right? I mean, the city of Montpelier or the city of Burlington or others, they make planning decisions every day. If somebody wants to build a new house in the middle of nowhere, they say, well, we are going to build a road to connect your house to the rest of the infrastructure, right? And so they can choose not to build that road. They can choose to densify the downtown district to make cities more walkable, right? All of those things start with the government, and then the private sector layers on its solutions on top of it.
How else would you push Vermont as we are thinking about opportunities in climate change, areas for growth, areas for reducing growth as well? Where would you push Vermont?
Well, the number one thing I would do is to institute a carbon tax. Now, the carbon tax could be ridiculously small. It could be $3 a ton, so it doesn't really affect people. But getting people to think carbon, particularly accountants and CFOs, is critical. Excuse me. But that's the number one thing, is getting people to see this as waste. All of the money that we're spending on heating and cooling and transportation services, and even in the ag sector in Vermont, you have a vibrant ag sector that could lead the nation in anaerobic digesters, which produces heat, biomethane, electricity. Massachusetts has banned food waste from the landfills, which Vermont is copying, I think, by 2020. Mm-hmm. There's huge opportunities to do this, but putting a carbon price on, even if it's tiny, matters because it forces everyone in the finance sector to start using their brain to think about how to eliminate that waste out of their budgets.
Jigarshaw is president and co-founder of Generate Capital, a company that funds small-scale clean tech businesses. He's the keynote speaker at a summit today at Vermont Technical College in Randolph, being put on by the Vermont Council on Rural Development. The summit's focus is on creating prosperity and opportunity confronting climate change. Jigar, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. It was great to be back in Vermont.
Coming up, how to eat healthy on a budget. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Talk to a doctor or listen to health professionals on talk shows, and the key message is to maintain a healthy diet. That means buying plenty of fruits and vegetables, but it is challenging to stock your refrigerator and cupboards with healthy food, especially on a tight budget. Blend in messages about the value, or lack thereof, of eating organic, using supplements, and following the latest health wave, like a gluten-free diet, and it all gets a little bit confusing. So here to help us through some of these issues is Mary Saucier-Choate. She's the food and nutrition educator for the co-op food stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction. Mary, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the basics of nutrition. What are the most important elements to eating healthily?
I would definitely say getting in whole foods like fruits and vegetables and whole grains.
We hear a lot of advertisements that say made with whole grains, and it would suggest to you that that product is healthy, but whole grains can still contain a lot of bad things if it's a product that's, you know, fatty and sugary.
Well, whole grains that are just the whole grain, of course, are fine. They have naturally occurring oils in them. But you're right, made with is the key red flag to look for. If it says made with, they may have put in a little bit of whole grain or a lot. So what I encourage folks to do is when they're looking at a label to look for 100% whole grain or 100% whole wheat or whatever the grain is. That's the easy way. But if it doesn't say that, if it says like multigrain or 12 grain, to go ahead and look at the ingredient label, because they want to look for the word whole and they want that whole grain to be the first ingredient on the ingredient label.
And generally, I mean, if you're looking at a fruit or a vegetable or a product that is just the grain itself, then you know exactly what you're getting. So that's a good place to start.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Getting the whole food, like an apple or a banana,
right.
Of course, you know that's what you're getting. The less processing, the better. Although, you know, you don't have to only eat whole grains, you know, as whole grains. Certainly eating breads are fine as long as they're made, you know, with simple ingredients, you know, water, yeast, salt, whole grain are good. Good ones to shoot for.
When people talk about eating fruits and vegetables, that's obviously very important. And you think about buying those things, and often they're very expensive, especially if you start to get into organic products or sometimes local products, which you may want to buy either for health reasons because you know where they're coming from or to support your local growers. They can also sometimes be expensive. So how do you stay healthy on a tight budget?
That's such a great question, Jane, and I want to sort of refer to what you said at the beginning. If you think you have to buy all organic or you have to include supplements, if that's where you're starting from, then of course there's no way you can do that on a tight budget. So I would say hold off on the supplements and try to get your nutrition from whole foods where they're generally much more effective nutrients when they're coming from a whole food than from an isolated supplement. And as far as organic and local, which are great things to support, even the Environmental Working Group, which puts out their list of like 10 things to buy organic and 10 things never to buy conventional, even they say right on their webpage now, they say it's better to eat fruits and vegetables and plenty of them than to eat organic only, because the benefits of eating fruits and vegetables are so deep and broad. When they look at, you know, populations of people who are eating the most fruits and vegetables, those are the ones who have, you know, lesser risk of heart disease and cancer and all sorts of chronic diseases, whether or not they're organic. But of course, organic is great for supporting the environment. And when you can afford it, that's really good. And, you know, if you just watch the prices, you can see things on sale. I've seen organic carrots cheaper than regular conventional carrots. So, but you have to watch for those sales.
Can you still get all the nutrients you need from fruits and vegetables if you're buying canned fruits and vegetables? Often those are really cheap options.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because that's another thing that's a misconception. People think, oh my God, I have to eat fresh all the time. I don't have time. I don't have the skills to do fresh all the time. And it's definitely a mixture is the way to go for a healthy diet and for a healthy budget. Canned vegetables, when you cook a vegetable, so canned are already cooked, you are able to better absorb some of the beta carotenes and fat soluble nutrients that are released because the cell walls are sort of broken down. So some nutrients are more available to you from canned than from fresh. And some Nutrients are more available from fresh, like vitamin C. You lose some vitamin C, not all of it, but you lose some when you cook a vegetable and a fruit. So it's a good idea to mix it up. And when they look at them side by side, fresh, canned, and frozen, the nutrients are very comparable. So it's a good idea for your budget to mix those things up.
So if you're busy and you think, well, I don't have a lot of vegetables, but I've got these, you know, frozen peas in the refrigerator, you don't have to feel bad about that, basically.
Exactly, exactly. Oh, it's such a helpful thing to have frozen and canned when you're on a budget, if you're busy, because it's an easy way to get these fruits and vegetables in that are so important.
You know, that seems so obvious, Mary. I mean, a vegetable's a vegetable, and when you talk about the science that's been done to lay them side by side, but I think there is often some guilt that you feel like you should be eating fresh and you should be eating local. And we hear a lot about the value of cooking food, you know, cooking it yourself. And so there does seem to, I don't know, it almost feels like cheating sometimes if you're just taking something frozen out of the freezer.
The way to make it all happen, unless, you know, there are certainly people who are unbelievable chefs and they have it down to a science and they can start fresh and have a meal on the table in 30 minutes. But for most of us, you know, you get kids running around, you got commitments, you're very short on time. It's a way to mix it up. So what I'm thinking is some fresh, some canned, some frozen, however it works for your meal that night. For example, making a pizza, and you know, you could get fresh tomatoes and make sauce for that pizza that night. But most people are like, no. So you get a jar of, you know, tomato sauce and get some frozen vegetables, zap them, put them on the pizza, you know, get some cheese, and you know, grating it yourself is cheaper, but if you get grated cheese, you know, throw that on, it's still going to be a cheaper pizza and healthier than one you would buy somewhere else. Because you can get a whole grain crust. You can get low sodium or lower sodium tomato sauce. You see what I'm saying? It's even when you use some convenience foods like the grated cheese, it's still going to be not a $14 pizza if you're doing like a whole grain crust and the things we talked about.
Mm-hmm. And maybe not a 1,400 calorie meal.
Right. And high sodium. Right. You can definitely control the health of your meal when you cook at home. I'm a huge promoter of cooking at least sometimes at home because of those reasons. But I feel so strongly about this is that I developed a class series called Extreme Beginner Cooking Class because I think the thing that's missing is people don't know how to cook. They don't feel comfortable cooking, and so they don't. Mm-hmm. And so I've developed a series of Extreme Beginner Cooking Classes, assuming that you don't know anything about cooking and you're just starting. So they're really easy recipes using, you know, one is focused on things to do with vegetables, you know, things to do with pasta and grains, and these are all whole grains. Know, things to do with less expensive meat, poultry, fish, and so on. You know, so people, if they took the whole series, they'll leave there with a huge palette of ideas on how to eat cheaply on a budget.
Let's talk a little bit about supplements. They've come under fire recently, most recently because of missing or harmful ingredients. In some cases, what was advertised on the bottle, there was none of that in the bottle at all. So what's going on there? Is there a place for supplements in a healthy diet, or should people avoid them?
You know, the jury is still out on that. Supplements have a place for certain people under certain conditions. Like if you say you just hate dairy products or you can't tolerate dairy products and you know, dairy in our country is like the best way to get calcium and the easiest way. But if you can't tolerate that, then, you know, you can certainly look for calcium fortified foods and, you know, make up the difference with a supplement. Up here where we live, where there's not a lot of sunlight that activates the vitamin D in our skin during most of the year, you know, maybe a vitamin D supplement might be warranted if you're not able to get out in the sun or you just don't get out in the sun during the summer.
Well, what about something like a multivitamin?
Yeah, multivitamins can be helpful. They can also be fake insurance, because a lot of folks think that. Would you think if you took a multivitamin that said complete or something like that, that you would be getting all the calcium you needed? Mm. Wouldn't you? I mean, most
sure.
people would.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not.
Calcium
is too big a vitamin to fit, a mineral to fit into a multivitamin. It would be huge. You'd never be able to choke it down. So, so a lot of times that's kind of misleading. And then a lot of multis might have iron that some people want to avoid. You know, some people retain too much iron, postmenopausal women aren't losing iron, so they don't need as much iron. So it's, I guess the big thing is, I guess if you knew that you weren't eating certain foods that you needed, a multivitamin might help. But it's not a replacement, because even when they say, oh, this has like 10 servings of fruit in it or whatever they say about certain multivitamins, there's no way, because there's fiber in fruit. There are phytochemicals. These are compounds in fruits and vegetables and plant foods that are known to be beneficial that they are still discovering. So there's no way they can put all that fiber and all these other things in a pill. Number one, because like the fiber would be too big, and the phytochemicals, they haven't discovered them all yet. So there's no substituting real food, I guess is what I'm saying. A multivitamin can be like a little supplement, like it's supposed to be, if you wanted. But it is possible to get everything you need pretty much from foods. I mean, there are some exceptions, like I said, with calcium, if you're not eating it. People over 50, it's recommended that they take a B12 supplement or get it from fortified foods, because a good portion of adults have something called achloridia, so they're not producing enough stomach acid to break the B12 from the protein that it's generally bound to. B12 comes from animal foods. Mm-hmm. So then most of us should be taking a B12 supplement or getting it from fortified foods, which is easy to do. A lot of foods, a lot of cereals and stuff have B12 added to it.
Mary Saucier-Choate is the food and nutrition educator for the co-op food stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction. Mary, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Jane.
And that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, I will be joined by Governor Peter Shumlin. We'll have a wide-ranging discussion covering topics at the State House, and we want you to help shape the conversation. What questions do you want to ask the governor? Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri, with production assistance from Devin Karambalis. Peter Biello directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. We had special engineering assistance today from Chris Albertine, and thanks to Mary Jean Taylor and Michael Levine at Vermont Technical College for their help with today's broadcast. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.